Good, the first two lectures will be about compartmentalized granular gases, and the last lecture, which will be the very last lecture in this complete workshop, I will keep somewhat lighter with lots of movies and so, and it will be about impacts on solid granular matter. So, why do we speak about granular matter? Well, this doesn't look like granular matter, and it isn't. But if you say that about 70% of this world is covered by water, it's safe to say that the rest is covered by granular material, like these beautiful sand dunes somewhere in the desert. But it's virtually everywhere, not only in nature, beach, soil, snow, desert, rubble on mountains and things like that, sea floor, Saturn's rings, asteroids, but also in industry. In most of our industries, granular material takes a prominent place. For instance, in mining industry, here you see a conveyor belt in the mining industry, and here the pharmaceutical industry, and the middle one is actually from my own kitchen. The food industry also employs granular matter at a regular basis. So, granular matter can behave like a solid, as for instance this pile of potatoes. If you simply lay it down and let it be, then it will behave like an ordinary solid, but with special features. It can also behave like a liquid. Here you see sand in an hourglass, which is flowing down, and also then it behaves like an ordinary liquid, but with very special features, because for instance the flow in the liquid would of course be proportional to this height, because the pressure would be proportional to this height, but this is not the case in sand, and that's why it's used as a timing device. The stream here, the mass stream through this device is constant. And where we'll be concentrating on is granular material as a gas. And these are Saturn's rings, and I won't be discussing Saturn's rings, but a somewhat different type of experiment, in which we take a container, a glass container, we divide it into two compartments, and we shake it, we vibrate it from the bottom. And what happens then is if we shake vigorously, then the particles distribute themselves over the two compartments. But if we reduce the driving strength, then something special happens. All particles go into one of the two compartments. And why does that happen? Well, this is because of the inelastic collisions between the particles. So if by a statistical fluctuation one compartment has somewhat more particles, there will be somewhat more collisions, there will be somewhat more energy loss, particles will become slower, they will not make it over the walls easily anymore. You get a kind of snowball effect in which almost all particles end up in one of the two compartments and the other one is almost emptied. Well, these inelastic collisions are quantified by the normal restitution coefficient E, and in a head-on collision in the center of mass of the two particles, it's defined as the ratio of the incoming and the outgoing velocities of the particles. So how to model this clustering? Well, we note that if you would plot the outflow from one compartment into the other, that first, as a function of the number of particles in that compartment, that first the flux would go up, as you would expect, but then due to the inelastic collisions, it would reach a maximum, and then it would go down again. And this way, it is possible that two compartments with different amounts of particles can balance each other, and we reach a steady state situation in which we have a different amount of particles in each compartment. So the functional form that we use for this flux function is due to Jens Eggers, who wrote it down in a PRL of 1999. And, basically nk in this formula is the fraction of particles in compartment K, and the important parameter is this B, which is proportional to what is standing over here. Well, this is basically the energy needed to make it up to the wall for a particle, and this is basically the energy that it gets at the bottom. 1 minus E squared is due to the inelastic collisions, and note that if the interactions are completely elastic, then this E would be equal to 1, B would be 0, and we would be left with a continuously increasing monotonous flux function. Well, how to derive such a flux function? I will give a very comparatively easy argument. First, we define the granular temperature, and in such a system where there are no where there is no macroscopic flow, I'm looking at a single compartment now, this granular temperature is proportional to the velocity fluctuations, and I will take it equal to that. And for a dilute system, we find that this granular temperature is roughly independent of height. And then, from momentum conservation, we can directly derive that then the density should obey the barometric height distribution, and that's this a famous expression that you will probably have seen before. Now, if we look in particle simulations of a granular gas, then we indeed see that the granular temperature is more or less constant, and also that this note log scale here, that also the density follows roughly this barometric height distribution. Now, in a steady state, the temperature in the compartment follows from an energy balance. First, we have the energy input at the bottom. So this would be proportional to the probability of for a particle to collide with the bottom, which is the density at the bottom times the typical velocity for which we take the square root of the temperature, times the energy gain that it gets at the bottom. And well, this expression is simply rho zero from the barometric height distribution, times the square root of t, and then we have to get an expression for this delta in k. And, well, if we take, for instance, a sawtooth driving, so a driving with a constant velocity is moving upward, going down in an instant, moving upward at a constant velocity vb, then we can find, simply by comparing the energy of an in and an outgoing particle, that it should be 2 times the mass of the particle times the velocity of the bottom times the square root of the temperature. We plug that in. This energy input at the bottom should be equated with the energy dissipation in the system. Here, epsilon is 1 minus E squared, where E was the restitution coefficient. And well, the dissipation is the integral over the whole system of the density squared, because these are binary collisions, times the probability of having this collision, which would be, again, times the square root of t. Then we have the energy loss in a single collision, and that's equal to epsilon times t. And we arrive at the following. The only thing that we need to do is to evaluate this integral here. And if we do so, then we find g n squared over 2t. And there it is. Now we equate the two energy input and the energy dissipation rates, and we get that g times n times vb is proportional to g times epsilon times m squared times the square root of t. And therefore, t, and that's the most important thing, is proportional to 1 over the number of particles squared. Now that we know the temperature or the functional dependence of the temperature of the important on the important parameters of our system, we can write down the flux through a small hole at the height h, where capital S is the surface of the hole. Namely, we simply take the density at that height, we multiply it with the typical velocity of the particle at that height, times the area of the hole. And this again leads to the following proportionality: density of height h, the square root of t1 times s, and we fill in the formula for the barometric height distribution to arrive at this expression. And then the last thing that we have to do is to use the expression we found on the previous page for T1, do some calculus, and then we indeed find the formula that I've shown you a few slides ago that was derived by Jens Eggers. It's proportional to n1 squared times the exponent of minus bn squared.
One refers to the...
Well, to one of the compartments. I mean, it could have made it an I or so. The one refers to the fact that we're looking at the flux out of compartment number one. So, if we look at the bifurcation diagram of the system, so this is the experimental bifurcation diagram. Here we have the fraction in each of the two compartments, in either of the two compartments. Here we have this parameter B, and B was inversely proportional to the amplitude and frequency of the driving squared. So vigorous B means vigorous driving means small b. So then we have a situation in which both compartments get just as much particles, and then at a certain point in time it gives way to a clustered state. Now, if we look at what the theory predicts, we write down based on this flux model a simple balance equation, namely that the time rate of change of the fraction of particles in compartment 1 is what comes in from its neighbor minus what goes towards its neighbor, and of course the total number of particles should be conserved. So the total fraction should add up to 1. And this is the result of the theoretical calculation. So we have a stable equally distributed case for vigorous driving, which at B equals 1 gives way through pitchfork bifurcation to a clustered state, and there at that point also the uniform distribution becomes unstable. We can directly generalize this for more compartments. So here I wrote down the dynamics for an n compartment system, and now we have the same type of balance equation, but we now have two neighbors which can give us particles, and we have to give particles to two neighbors. There is a noise term. The effects, however, of this noise term we will not consider here, and the total number of particles is conserved, which leads to this second rule. Now, this leads to bifurcation diagrams like this one for 5 compartments. We can draw them for any number of compartments. And here, again, we find the stable uniform distribution for vigorous driving, which then gives way, but now through a first-order phase transition to the clustered state. And here there are some transient states which will play a role later in my lecture.
Sorry, so when do you see a discontinuous stream?
Oh, here.
Compartments.
So you basically here, the stable cluster is here. And so what you would do is, for instance, if you lower your shaking strength towards there, you would jump to the clustered state from here. And if you do it the other way around, so if you increase your driving strength, then you would jump from the clustered state towards the uniform state at this point, and there is a large hysteresis between the two.
And to see this, do you need 5 compartments?
No, also 3 compartments would work. Only 2 is the atypical case.
If you have several compartments that are occupied, do you know something about this spatial arrangement? Do they tend to be next to each other, or do they tend
I'll come back to that later, but there is a tendency to not be next to each other, clusters, but it's a small tendency.
The 2 is special because there is a symmetry between the 2 when you do the expansion, is that?
The 2 is special in many ways. There are also a colleague of mine tried to map this onto a Potts model, and there is also for a two-state system there is a special case that you have a continuous phase transition, and for more levels there it's
so if you do the free energy expansion, it's even, I guess, in the order parameter.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So this is how such a system looks in experiment. We have five compartments here, and you quickly see that clusters form. So there was something like a cluster in here, but now there are two clearly distinguishable clusters in the second and the fifth compartment. But also this one quickly vanishes. It corresponds to such a transient state, and eventually all particles end up into one cluster.
If I look at that movie,
yes,
there's a lot of particles that are way above the notional compartment.
Yes.
It looks like they have some lateral momentum. I mean, are they in any compartment?
Sorry?
No.
Yeah.
In your movie,
yeah,
many of the particles are jumping way above the
yes.
boundaries between compartments.
Mm-hmm.
And also they seem to have some transverse momentum.
Okay, yeah, sure, they will.
So are they really in any compartment, or are they just...
Well, this system is actually more for, let's put it, pedagogical purposes, because you do not expect such a system to be really described by a flux model like I showed you, because there is no, particles can go over many compartments, there is no small outflow from a single compartment, etc. So it's more just to show how it works. But there are things to say about that. For instance, that the flux high up will be relatively small as compared to just above the bottom. So if you take, for instance, a mean free path length above a wall as a typical size of a hole, you can still work with the same model and get reasonable results.
Yes? What about the walls of the container? Do they have any effect?
The walls have an effect, and usually if we do experiments, we do it in a cyclic system, but that's difficult to image. But I will show you some more. The walls do have an effect, obviously. If they are somewhat dissipative, then they will create clusters at the sides. And if they're very reflecting, they will ensure that your clusters will not come into the box is just assigned to the walls. So I'll come back to clustering later when we will be discussing coarsening in these types of systems. But first, I want to say a few words about declustering. And declustering is the opposite of clustering. And that's for an industrial applications. That's the more wanted situation, because there people do not want to create clusters, but they want to get rid of them for obvious reasons. And here is an example. This is from a device which is meant to separate the metal particles from car debris. So if you have a car which has been pulled together and cut into little pieces, then you have pieces from the chairs, etc., which will be light, and there are pieces of metal, and you want to separate the two. And so he came up with this device, but for the device to work, you want an even distribution of all particles over the compartments, and that's not what he saw. He saw that particles would go to a certain amount of the compartments, and there would hardly be any flow, so they would be useless. And there would be a few compartments which were completely empty, which would be useless for the sense that there are almost no particles and nothing is happening. So, in the model, we will concentrate on the region where the cluster has become unstable, so that's for vigorous driving here, and look at what happens. First, I'll show you an experiment starting with a cluster in the middle compartment, and the walls go up till here. And we shake hard enough to break the cluster down. And what you see is that it doesn't seem to work. Particles are getting out, but the cluster is still clearly visible even now. And it takes actually a long time before the cluster is completely destroyed, which will happen almost now, I guess. There it is. So now it's gone. And now we got to the declustering. But to take a few frames from this movie, at T is 1, 22, and 42 seconds, we can clearly see the cluster in there, and only within 1 second the cluster then disappears. If we plot the fraction of particles in the cluster, then we see that at first very little is happening, and then very suddenly the cluster disappears. And this also allows us to define a lifetime of such a cluster, tau. And, well, we did many numerics and experiments of these lifetimes as a function of the driving parameter B, and for many number of compartments in our system. And we see some very typical features. First of all, very near to the critical BC, there where the cluster becomes stable, the lifetime diverges, as it should be. And if we are far from these critical points, we find that independent of the number of compartments in our system, all data lie onto a single line, and we were able to derive this expression here for the lifetime. And it would fetch a bit too far to really derive this expression here, but well, we can do it for the three compartment system. And there we have a cluster in the middle compartment, and then by symmetry the other two compartments will have the same number of particles, which would then be 1/2 times 1 minus the density of the cluster. We can write down our balance equation and fill in what we know from the particle fractions, and we find an expression in the cluster density only. Now, this we can invert, and that leads to the following expression for the lifetime tau. And if you compare that to the numerical data and the experiments, then there is a very good agreement. Now, how would this look in a larger system? So here, there is a cluster in the somewhat the middle of 80 compartments. Oh, and this is a little bit strange. Well, okay. Let me see. It's somewhat larger than I expected it to be. But actually, well, there's not so much to see like this. What you should focus on is here. This is a region where the cluster first was. Well, the cluster disappeared. And now there is a kind of a hilly structure that depletes. And I'll, oh, no, I cannot. Ah, here. Here you still see the remnants of what it was below. That's when you work with different screen resolutions. Now, if we plot the density of the cluster and the width of a cluster as a function of time, here this doubly logarithmic plot, we can clearly see the event of the sudden death, where the cluster suddenly dies and goes down, and material is suddenly spread into the other compartments. And then, when we wait a bit longer, the width and the height of the cluster follow. So this is the spreading profile. Follow a power law, and they go as t to the power 1/3 and t to the power of minus 1/3, respectively. Now, why is this so? To analyze this, we go from our discrete system of n minus 1 coupled ordinary differential equations to a continuous system. And then we get the following equation here, with a dn dx squared term and the second derivative of n to x squared. And this looks very much like the Carla-Parisi-Zhang equation, only now the coefficients c and d are not constants, but they also depend on the fraction of particles. Now, if we look in the limit of very vigorous driving, or very low number of particles in the compartment, we get the following equation, and if we use a self-similar ansatz in which particle density, sorry. Yeah.
So one important ingredient here is that n is the sum over all n's should be 1.
Yes.
So how do you take...
it becomes an integral over n, yes, over space.
I mean, do you take that into account in your equation?
Somewhere? Yes. Yeah. This is taken into account. So actually this is an extra boundary condition here that you need to imply on the system. So we take this self-similar ansatz with a dimensionless variable, space-time variable, which combines space and time, x over a to the power 1/3 times t to the power 1/3. And if we plug this into that equation, we get the following simple ordinary differential equation. And if we solve that, it turns out that it has a very simple solution. It's a parabola upside down, and this parabola describes the depletion of this pattern that you have seen in the, well, that you could have seen in the simulation.
Okay. A few slides ago you had a curve that said width.
Yes.
What is that?
It's the width of this, yeah. I couldn't really show you, but if you would have seen that simulation, and as would have been the case, you would have first seen this cluster in the center, and then once the cluster was gone, there would be a decaying profile which would roughly have this shape. And it's the width of this shape that was plotted in that function. And the other one is the height. So, I now come to the second part of this first lecture, and that's about coarsening. And coarsening is a phenomenon that you know from everyday life. For instance, if you take a salad dressing made of oil and vinegar and you shake it, then there are very, very little drops of the one constituent into the other, and they will, if you wait a little bit, they will merge into larger drops until there is a complete separation of the two of the mixture. So here you see the same kind of this demixing in for tin particles in a liquid tin lead alloy, but probably also very familiar to you is that what happens in a beer. If you just pour a beer in a glass, then you will have very, very small cells of foam. They will coarsen over time. They will grow, get bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually they will become very big. And the average length, you can quantize this, for instance, by the average bubble edge length, which grows as, in this case, t to the power 1/2. So in any coarsening system, the thing that you would like to know is how does a typical length scale or a typical scale of your system grow? Also, our compartmentalized granular gas has coarsening behavior. You have seen it a little bit in the 5-compartment system, but here I show you a 12-compartment system. This is our experimental setup of 12 compartments connected by slits. And at t is 0 seconds, we have a homogeneous mixture of particles over the compartments. Then at 55 seconds, we see 4 clusters emerge. Then at 100 seconds, one of these clusters vanishes and there are only 3 left. At 190, we only have 2 left, and at 780, we finally are left with 1 cluster. So if you make a timeline of these events, then you see that the system goes from 4 to 3 to 2 to 1 cluster in ever-increasing time steps. So here's a small movie of the first stage. I won't show you the complete movie because it takes a long time for the complete process to evolve. But here's the beginning, so from the uniform distribution into the three cluster state. So here you clearly see already some clustering going on. Eventually there will be only three of them left. So that's about what happens now. So here there is a clear cluster, there is a clear cluster, and there is one. Then somewhat later, we are still in the three cluster state. We see, we just started the movie at the moment that this cluster starts to dissolve itself. And so particles come out of there. You see that the particles in between become more and more lively. And eventually, if we wait a little bit, then this cluster will dissolve itself. The particles will spread out over the intermediate compartments and eventually be absorbed by the two remaining clusters. And then the same event happens another time to go to the only stable state of the system, and that's the one cluster state. Good, if we draw the bifurcation diagram for the 12-compartment system, which looks like this, then we start out somewhere there, and we move through the system to the one-cluster state, and initially we find that the number of clusters that we have in the system depends on the distance to the critical point here, so the farther the distance, the smaller the initial number of clusters, the larger the initial number of clusters, and it follows the power law of B minus BC to the power 0.28, for which we do not have a real explanation yet. And then we get stuck in a transient state corresponding to four clusters. Then on a somewhat slower time scale, we go to three, we go to two, and to one. Now, in an even larger system, it would look somewhat like this. I fear that the same will happen as we've seen before, but I'll try to get it a little bit into... So.
I could use the icon.
No, that doesn't work. Yeah, that doesn't work with this. But it's clear here what happened. So we saw some clusters emerge. And we see now here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 clusters. And in intermediate compartments, there is a kind of more or less hill-like structure going up. And I'll leave this running and go to the back to the simulation. And actually, we find that this coarsening process, the coarsening towards the only stable one-cluster state, goes in two stages. So in the first stage, we see that all clusters grow and that the intermediate boxes are depleted as 1 over t. So the amount of particles in the intermediate region goes as 1 over t. Then, once the material has all streamed out of the in-between compartments, then we get a slow cluster-to-cluster dynamics. And this cluster-to-cluster dynamics is governed by, as we will show later, a kind of a renormalized version of the original balance equation. Namely, now the index I goes only over the clusters, so the time rate of change of the fraction in cluster I is what comes in from cluster I minus 1 and I plus 1, but renormalized with their distances to this cluster, minus what goes out towards those cluster, also renormalized by the distance in compartments to the cluster. I will explain those two stages now, after I've shown you a numerical result for 20 compartments. Here we initially, so here we have the particle fraction in the 20 compartments as a function of time in a doubly logarithmic plot. And we start out with a more or less uniform, more or less random configuration of fractions in the compartments, and very quickly we see that five clusters emerge, and in between, the compartments in between are depleted, and you see this line here has a slope minus one, which corresponds to the 1 over t decay of the intermediate regions. Then, at a certain point in time, we see that some of the intermediate compartments get a more or less constant profile. That's what's happening here or here. And this is the phase in which there is cluster-to-cluster transport, until, very suddenly, one of the clusters dies, and then the material streams into the compartments around it, and we go on with 1 over t depletion until the next event. It's good to note that the lifetime of the transient states here seems to grow super exponentially. So if it would have been exponentially, then the distances between these events would have been equal in this logarithmic plot. But since it's growing even in this logarithmic scale, it's super exponential. Now, let's concentrate on the first stage first. Take a bit of water. And that's the decay of the hilly structure in between clusters. Now, as a reminder, the set of ordinary differential equations that describes the time evolution of the system can be written in a partial differential equation of this shape, and we do the same trick that we also did in explaining this decay of the one cluster state. Namely, we take the continuum limit and we do a self-similarity ansatz. Only now our boundary conditions are somewhat different. Namely, we have the two clusters which act as absorbing boundaries and simply absorb all the material that goes in there. So we have to try a different self-similar ansatz, which looks like this. It's a function of the dimensionless variable psi is x over the half the distance of the profile. And if we insert this in the partial differential equation, we end up with an ordinary differential equation which can be solved numerically and gives the following shape. But the important thing here is the dependence of the profile on time, and it says that the profile decays as 1 over t, which indeed corresponds to what we see in experiment and in the numerics. Now, the second stage is about the cluster-to-cluster transport. What happens then is that all the material has streamed out of the intermediate compartments and went into the two clusters on the side. And then what we get is a more or less constant profile that forms, and the only function of this profile is to transmit particles from the lower cluster towards the higher cluster. And the profile between the clusters will be such that the net box-to-box flux fnk plus 1 minus fnk is constant. And this means that if we write down for instance, this cluster k here, the time rate of change of the fraction in the cluster, that's fnk plus 1 minus fnk, plus further contributions from the other side. And since this, so that's the net flux from here to there, but since this net flux is everywhere the same in this whole profile, it can also be written as 1 over the distance times the outflux of the lower cluster minus the outflux of the higher cluster. So this expression, and this leads to the renormalized version of the equation that I've shown you before. Note that if we now go from an index k, which runs over the individual boxes, to an index I which runs over the clusters only, we get the shape that you've seen before, namely the renormalized version of the original balance equation, but now running over clusters only. But now you can ask yourself the question, how relevant could such a flux function be if we have fractions in between, which are something of the order of 10 minus 14 or so. Such, if you would look in an experiment, then what you would see is two clusters, and most of the time nothing would happen. Only occasionally one particle would leave a cluster and then go to the intermediate compartments, either to the cluster next to it or is reabsorbed by the same cluster. So what a particle would do is perform a random walk in the intermediate compartments. And, well, this is a very well-known problem from probability theory, which is known as the gambler's ruin problem. So you give a gambler $1, and you can then compute the to play a game with a which has a bet of $1, and then compute the probability that in the end he will come home, for instance, with n dollars. And if you compute this probability, you see that it's 1 over n. So for our particle coming out of cluster I, which will perform this random walk in the intermediate compartments, there will be a probability of 1 over di I plus 1, where di I plus 1 is the distance between the two clusters to actually go into the next cluster. And so there's probably 1 minus this thing to be reabsorbed by the cluster it was originally coming from. Now, if we combine this into a similar equation as we had before, then we get that the time rate of change of the fraction in compartment I is the flow, the outflow rate, the rate at which particles go out of cluster I. And that's simply the flux function evaluated in this compartment. And then suppose that it's out, that it has a probability of 1 minus 1 over di minus 1 I to go into the next compartment. And such we have this part of the expression. We can do the same for the other side and for the clusters on both sides next to it, and we end up with this expression. And surprisingly, this is exactly the same equation as we got from the flux model. So also this completely unrelated random walk model of particles moving in between clusters leads us to exactly the same equation as we had before for the cluster-to-cluster transport. And now we come to the central question. So how does the particle fraction, how does the average cluster size grow with time? And to answer this, we first look at the lifetime of the L cluster state. And first, let all clusters be equally spaced for the sake of argument. So if we have K compartments and L clusters, then the average distance would be K over L. Then, if we write down the cluster-to-cluster equation, we have that the time rate of change of the fraction in cluster I would be 1 over this d times this expression here. And say that one of the clusters is going to collapse first. Well, it's because it's the smallest, its neighbors will merely act as absorbing boundaries for the clusters, so we can neglect these two terms in the equation, and we are left with the following expression, which is equal to that if we use the formula that was derived by Eggers. And this we can write somewhat differently as follows. And this expression can be integrated directly. And I won't go to the details, but this is the expression we eventually end up with. And it contains an imaginary error function and a term e to the b l squared, which is the most important term of the two. Now, if we plot this lifetime as a function of the number of clusters in the compartment, then you see that indeed, this is a logarithmic scale here, that indeed the lifetime grows super exponentially. And now, if we want to go from the lifetime of the L-clustered state to the average size of clusters as a function from time, we use that 1 over L is the average size of the cluster in the L-cluster state, and replace the lifetime of the L-cluster state by time. Since the lifetime of the L-cluster state, it was growing super exponentially, indeed is by far the largest part of the total time t. So if we do so, we get this expression here with this imaginary error function and the exponential, and both parts are dominated by the exponential here, so we can write that t is proportional to the e to the power b times nj squared. Now we are where we want to be, because we can now write that the average cluster size is proportional to the square root of the logarithm of t. So this is extremely slow. And indeed, if we compare what we see, what we have found here, to what we find in numerical simulations of the flux model, then we indeed see the square root shape here in the average cluster size as a function of the logarithm of time. And here we see it once more in a plot where we take the logarithm of both of these quantities, and we clearly see the slope 1/2 coming out. Now, in the meantime, I'll try to get back to our demonstration. And we see indeed that in the simulation there are only two clusters left, and this one is going to die at the expense of that one. And so we're almost finished in this coarsening process here. Now, why is the clustering so slow? It is directly connected to the shape of the tail of the flux function. So because the tail is going as e to the power minus bn squared, we find that the average cluster size goes as the square root of the logarithm of t. If the tail would be simply exponential, then the size of the clusters would grow as the logarithm of t. So that's what is shown here, and I will skip the details because it's a very similar calculation as you have seen before. And if we take an exponential tail for the flux function, then we will find that the average cluster size will grow as a power law. And what's nice to note is that if the tail goes as n to the power minus gamma, then njt grows as t to the power 1 over gamma plus 2. And if gamma goes to 0, then we recover the t to the power 1/2 power law that was found previously for the Beer case. So in our coarsening granular gas, this is really the most extreme limit that you can get for the coarsening process, so the fastest that you can coarsen. So I want to conclude. We found that coarsening in two compartmentalized granular gas is a two-stage process, where we have first formation of the clusters and then cluster-to-cluster dynamics on a much slower time scale. And in stage two, the average size of the clusters grows exceptionally slow, because it's over exponentially. That's the square root of the logarithm of t. I thank you for your attention.
Any questions?
Yeah. You had this flex function f is a function of n.
Yes.
But if I increase n very much so that the height becomes above the height of the barriers,
yes,
the flex should increase again.
Well, first of all, this is for a system where we have a slit at a certain height. So there will always be a certain probability that a particle then goes down and goes through the slit anyhow. But that was maybe not your question?
No, that is the question. So suppose the slit is at a particular height, and the number of particles in that cluster cannot exceed that height.
Yes.
So if the number of particles is much more, then there will be bigger flux out of it.
Yes.
So the function will not be just n squared to the power minus n squared, but plus another
t. You're right. So there are limits to what is experimentally feasible. Yeah. And this flux function formalism only holds if you have a nice parametric height distribution in each compartment. And, well, if it's simply filled with particles, then that's another thing indeed. Yeah.
Why on the picture are the two remaining cluster close one to each other and not at the opposite on the ring? It would be a more stable configuration.
Well, actually, this could have been evolved by chance from a certain initial situation. But actually, this picture was prepared that way. So, to be honest, this was simply made that way, because what we wanted to do for this picture is to measure the lifetime of one cluster as a function of the distance to the other. So, but in an experiment, this could have arisen as a result of a uniform distribution. But you're right that there is a somewhat higher probability to find clusters far apart than very close to each other.
You tried to carry out this experiment with two kinds of balls to see whether you have two species and...
Actually we did that. That's a completely different thing that we did. Not this coarsening experiment, but we looked at a two-compartment system with a binary granular mixture, so two sizes in there. And what we found there is that by changing the shaking strength, we could get all the particles to cluster into either one of the compartments. So there was a crossover where we would either get all the particles in the left or in the right compartment, only as a result of the drying.
If you have very many compartments and a very low concentration of particles,
yes,
will they always cluster, or is there some concentration below which entropy wins and they just rather explore space?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, experimentally, we're limited to a certain size because we cannot mount a very large system onto our shaker. But in principle, there will always be, if you have a little bit of driving, there will always be a probability that a ball goes out of a certain cluster. So as long as the clusters fit in your compartments, there will always be a little bit of transport. It may be on a very, very long time scale, but there will always be some transport which does this this coarsening business. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess it depends how much transport there is then, whether that might ever be sufficient to completely evaporate a cluster that's there and prevent it from forming. I'm wondering if there's actually a transition.
Yeah. Well, you must see that a cluster that is evaporating becomes more and more energetic as it is evaporating, because the number of balls in the compartment becomes lower and lower, and they will become more and more energetic. So eventually, if it will evaporate, then eventually it will evaporate.
In the experiment with a jet, when you just drop a sphere in materials, and then after you have a jet and you see cluster in it. Is it the same kind of mechanism? Or
very good. You're already pointing to my talk of Friday. But It's a similar kind of thing that is happening there, because there, just as here, the inelastic collisions between the particles is seen to be responsible for this clustering effect.
The density should be far smaller in the kind of a jet, no?
So yes, sure, and also it's not compartmentalized, but still, we did experiments and we simply checked what could be possible explanations, interaction with air, attraction between the particles themselves, and the only thing that remains is inelastic collisions between the particles. And we also did in that experiment, we did numerical calculations, so we simply had a jet, an artificial jet, and looked at what happened with only a restitution coefficient, and it clustered. So.
Any further questions? Let's thank the speaker again.